Greetings to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 19th of September, 2013, which happens to be Talk Like a Pirate Day. And this is Nav Briefing number 85, from Castaneda to Calica. I've been offline for a while. That is to say, I haven't made any nav briefings. I haven't done any nav briefings for about 3 weeks. And so I thought it would be appropriate to pick up the rhythm on this particular day, which is National Talk Like a Pirate Day in the United States of America. I think it's rather wonderful that such things even exist. And, of course, we in the GNE have a particular fondness for this wacky national holiday. You know, it shows something about the true colors of the Anthropos and what a silly beast the human creature can be. I don't know about the rest of you, but in my view, it's the silliness and playfulness of the Anthropos. That is to say, in myself, of course, as well as in others, that makes it so endearing. But, strange to say, the silly and playful side of the Anthropos, which is totally harmless, I mean, who can think of anything more harmless than a Talk Like a Pirate Day, instigated purely for the fun of it? Nevertheless, those qualities carry a side effect, you might say. They carry a particular risk. If I would sum it up, I would say that the sinister and malevolent animals among the human species take advantage of the innocent playfulness of the Anthropos in order to play their games, which are in no way innocent, nor are they playful. So, with that little introduction, I will first update you on where we stand in the timing parameters of navigation, and then I'll head into the main topic of this briefing, which concerns Carlos Castaneda, or if I were to betray my age, I would say Castaneda. And I want to go back into some of Castaneda's writings that I've actually been rereading over the past month or so, and bring forth to you some of the reflections I've been developing with the intention of showing their relevance to the GNE and more specifically to the Calica War Party. A couple of technical points before I begin. I'm recording on a new system here with a different mic, microphone, headset. So we'll see how that works out and if it delivers the level of sound and the quality that best serves these briefings. Also, there was a glitch on the previous briefing of the Bairavi offensive, a couple of minutes of distortion, which I intend to get around to correcting after I do this briefing. So, timing. Well, here we are, coming up to the fall equinox of September 2013. In the conventional calendar, this would indicate the first day of fall. But according to the Gaian calendar of Merita, it represents the midpoint of fall. So fall began around the 1st or 2nd of August. August has 31 days, so let's count, say, 30 days in August, and add to that 22 days. So what is conventionally called the fall equinox occurs around the 52nd day of fall, according to the Gaian calendar. Today is the 19th, making it the 14th day of the shift of Shodashi. Yesterday, September 18th, was a day of high significance in the GNE. You will recall that I noted that the conjunction of Venus and Saturn visible in the evening sky after sunset denotes the return of the sacred masculine. I also indicated how the lunar node, which cannot be observed, was deeply implicated in that conjunction. There have been some remarkable factors of celestial navigation unfolding since I last spoke to you. You recall that at the end of August, we were counting down the last days of that terrific and spectacular Bhairavi shift, which ended on the 5th of September. And that transition from the Bhairavi shift into the current shift of Shodashi coincided with my 2-week trip in northern France. Also bear in mind that during the first 8 or 10 days of September, the planet Saturn was in exact conjunction to the star Kambalia, known as the Alchemist Star. I want you to bear in mind that the syntax or definitive meme, if you will, of the lunar perigee is divine alchemy. I established that point at the beginning of the GNE. The definitive syntax for the lunar apogee is divine memory. But returning to the potent theme of divine alchemy, one must always bear in mind that there is one particular star in the entire range of the zodiac that is associated with the divine alchemy of the wisdom goddess. Now, the lunar perigee moves through the sky and moves against the background of the 13 constellations of the zodiac in a cycle of about 8 or 8.5 years. So the index of divine alchemy signified by the lunar perigee is movable, but at the same time there is an immovable point in the zodiac, that faint little star located very close to the ecliptic, that is to say the orbital plane of the Earth where the Sun moves, and defining the absolute limit of the constellation of the Virgin. You can place it on her knee if you would like. Kambalia marks the left knee of the Virgin and the limit of the composite stars of that constellation. In my experience and in my intuition developed from years of sky watching, I would say that the first week or 10 days of September 2013 were in some way or another involved with operations of divine alchemy in a particular and specific way, but not a way that is necessarily easy to define, not in a manner that can be perhaps openly stated. As you know, I've spent more time in the GNE briefings talking about the apogee moments. It's easier to talk about the operations of the second attention of the Divine Sophia and the recapitulation of her own cosmic biography than it is to talk about the operations of divine alchemy. The operations of divine alchemy are deeply mysterious. But having said that, I want to add that those of you who follow the Sophianic myth and live in the dynamics of human imagination, as you engage that myth, will be deeply involved and implicated in this divine alchemy one way or another. You know, the divine alchemy of the Aeon Sapphire is sort of like the alchemy of your digestive system. Right now, as I speak, there are enzymes in your stomach, and there are polypeptides and enzymes and other chemicals operating in your digestive system, in your stomach, and in your intestines, of which you have no knowledge whatsoever, of which you have no sensation. And if you do have a sensation, then something's wrong with your system, right? The operations of divine alchemy in the catabolism and metabolism of the human animal are intended to be veiled from you in many respects, because you don't need to know how they work. You don't need to know how you digest the apple that you just ate in order to digest it. And fortunately, you don't. This is part of the way that the conditions of life are set up in this experiment, obviously. Well, likewise, for the operations of divine alchemy of the Aeon Sapphire on the cosmic scale, penetrating into the operations of her first attention would be comparable to trying to become conscious of the metabolism and catabolism of polypeptide chains in your own digestion, or of, even at a deeper level, of operations in the ribosomes of your cell, or operations in the epigenesis of DNA and RNA. Having said that, however, I would add with great pleasure and delight that there are moments of acute intuitive knowledge, and there are moments of sensorial -mystical revelation when these things can be known. They just cannot be known all the time. If they were known all the time, if your first attention were engaged with the first attention of the Aeon Sapphire, you wouldn't be able to function, because your first attention, the capacities of your first attention, which you rely on to function in a normal manner, would be consumed and overly engaged by the complexity of those processes. Nevertheless, at moments, in the first 10 days of September 2013, were such a moment. It becomes possible not only to glimpse deeply the operations of divine alchemy, but also to participate in those operations. So there was a remarkable kickoff this year in transition from the Bhairavi shift, which was in so many ways spectacular, into the shift of Shodashi. And there was a gorgeous omen at the beginning of the new shift around the 8th of September. I remember seeing it on the TGV, the high-speed train, when I was in France. I was traveling from Avignon to Toulouse, more or less directly east to west across that area of southern France. And I witnessed the towers of the medieval city of Carcassonne, and above them, the crescent moon of Shodashi, with Venus and Saturn in close proximity. That was a magnificent omen for me personally, considering the significance that the city of Carcassonne has played in my life over the last 8 years, or the last 5 years, excuse me, since I received the term of Gaia Awakening. And then, of course, on the 12th of September, Venus and Saturn were very close by, and the star Kambalia was part of that beautiful but modest omen to be seen in the evening skies. Finally, I should mention that on the 15th of September, there was perigee surge in 1 degree of the astrological sign Aquarius. Now, I haven't talked much about the progression of the perigee surges since I did the full model of hits in the scales and in the claws of the scorpion, have I? I would really like to pick up on that progression and bring it forward, make it current, and show where the progression leads in the next 6 months of the GNE. Just let me point out right now that this perigee hit, as we call it, that occurred on the 15th of September, which was a Sunday, was just in front of the gaze of the goatfish, at the head of the goatfish. And it was the first time the perigee had advanced into the goatfish. And what I want to point out right now in preview to a coming description of the perigee pattern is that in March 2014, at the conclusion of the 3 years, the perigee hits occur in the goatfish. And in fact, a hit in the tail of the goatfish signifies the completion of the 3 years. So the hit that occurred on the 15th of September at the head of the goatfish could be visually or imaginatively interpreted as looking forward to the conclusion of correction. The goatfish, you could say, represents the vision of Maha Kali as she guides us out of the illusion of linear time into the fractal splendor of simultaneity. The gaze of Kali, Maha Kali, the goatfish, is already seeing down 6 months of duration to the completion of this experiment. That is how I would interpret that recent perigee surge. Finally, I just want to say that it certainly is worth noting that World War III seems to have been evaded in the first 10 days of September 2013. Have you noted that? I mean, all the powers that be, the warmongers, the American military, and the bought-off politicians who are run by AIPAC and the Zionist Jews, were frothing at the mouth to do a replay of their Libya game, of their Iraq game. And for a while there, it really looked like they were going to pull off that act. It looked like they were going to replay the exact same script. And yet it didn't happen. There was a lot of pushback from the public. There was a lot of exposure within their own circles of power. And you might go so far as to say that the hand of Bayravi played a role here in clearing the obstacles that are presented by secrecy so that this scenario was stopped in its tracks. And you can say, to use a nautical expression, that Bayravi really cleared the decks during those first 10 days of September. Of course, don't be naive. We're still looking at a very dangerous scenario. And what has happened is that the obvious theatrics of the situation have been altered. But that doesn't mean that the powers behind the scenes who can actually make these things happen have abandoned their agenda. I would certainly not assume anything of the sort. Those powers who can instigate World War III at a nuclear level or a biochemical level will certainly do so. They don't need to go by the United Nations. The president doesn't need the approval of Congress. The Zads and the Zionists who are pulling the strings behind the scene certainly don't need anybody's approval. And so don't be fooled by that game. Nevertheless, even that game has been disrupted by some force, by some kind of intervention currently emerging out of the collective unconscious, or what I call the endopsyche of the human animal, E-N-D-O-P-S-Y-C-H-E, the endopsyche. The social subconscious produced a reaction that stopped a whole set of massively destructive events from occurring, didn't it? It's sort of like the analogy of a theater. Imagine that there is a theater piece being performed, like Les Miserables or something like that. And that halfway through the play being enacted on stage, be it a musical or whatever, the audience starts to protest against the play. The audience starts to attack and confront the actors. And as a result, the whole play has to be changed in mid-operation. This is sort of like what happened in the beginning of September 2013. So keep your vigil on current events, but keep your vigil more closely on the particulars of the GNE. And we'll see what unfolds in the next 3 decisive months. As far as I can tell from the GNE parameters, the decisive month is November 2013. That is the month when we can anticipate yet again another extremely intense convergence between Sophia's correction and the collective psychodrama being enacted on the global scale. So with those considerations out of the way, I'll turn directly to the main topic of this briefing, which concerns that colorful and legendary figure known as Carlos Castaneda. And in particular, it concerns the way in which Castaneda's myth and his message might be related to what we today are calling the Calico War Party. I think a good place to open this subject would be in response to a recent email from a crew member, Susanna, in East Village. On September 10th, she wrote, "Dear Nav, hello and greetings to you. I am writing to say that I am confused. Are we working towards saving A10 or aligning with Sophia towards implanting A11? On the one hand, you speak of extinction in NB83, and then you go on to talk about the Calico War Party and suggest that we take a stand in Sophia's correction." That's in quotes, take a stand in Sophia's correction. What does this mean? I am not sure that the crew gets it either. What exactly are we doing? I myself understand the situation is very far gone, but irrespective, why not fight? Why not take a stand, as you said? I mean, take a stand to save A10, meaning Anthropos 10. Imagine the anguish for Sophia if 10 creations are murdered. Why gather the Calico warriors if the whole deal here is over? Or is the aim to ease in A11? And so forth and so on. So these are very valid considerations. As I read this email, it struck me that other members of the crew might be pondering the very same questions. I realized that there are some points regarding the Calico War Party, as well as the distinction between Anthropos 10 and Anthropos 11, that I haven't made sufficiently clear so far. So now is the moment to do so. First off, how do we define Anthropos 10 in the framework of the Sophianic vision story, and more particularly in the framework of the GNE? Anthropos 10 is the 10th experiment with the generic Anthropos strain that was seeded in the Orion Nebula by the Pleuromic Aeons after it was designed by Sophia and Thelete, or Thelete. So, from that matrix of the human genome, a number of experiments developed. There were 9 previous to the current one, which we are in now. So we are Anthropos 10. It's not only a name for the 10th strain of the Anthropos genome, but also for the 10th experiment in a planetary setting. However, the Gnostic myth tells us that this particular experiment with Anthropos 10 is anomalous. Unlike the previous 9 experiments, which collapsed because the species turned against its environment, those experiments occurred in laboratory settings of various kinds that appeared in the galactic arms, according to the natural and ongoing conditions that cause planetary systems to arise, develop, and fade away within the physical conditions of the galactic arms. Anthropos 10, the current experiment, occurs on a planet which is formed from the organic light of the Aeon Sophia herself. So the laboratory setting is anomalous because she, the co-designer of the experiment, is in material immanence in the experiment. Remember the central riddle of correction. How are things different regarding Sophia's intervention in the human experiment underway? Different than they would have been had she not fallen into the experiment. She is now part of this experiment. She is both the setting of the experiment and the interactive aeonic presence interfacing with Anthropos 10. But one of the answers to the central riddle of correction, one of the many answers, because it's a pregnant riddle, is that being in material immanence in the planet, providing herself the laboratory setting for the experiment, the Aeon Sophia can mutate or morph Anthropos 10 into its next variation, Anthropos 11, which she is indeed doing as I speak. That is the deepest meaning, by the way, of the sequence of perigee surges that have proceeded since March of 2011. The perigee surges indicate the operations of the first attention of the Aeon Sophia, her divine alchemy, what I was told to call transspeciation in May of 2000 in Arc, France. When I stabilized perception of the organic light, I was told to call her alchemical, biochemical, biogenetic, and epigenetic mutation of humanity, transspeciation. So, with the powers of her first attention, which to a large degree remain unfathomable to the human animal, the Aeon Sophia is transmuting and transspeciating Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11. So what is the situation in the world today in response to Susanna's cogent question? Well, simple. There is a massive population of Anthropos 10 on the planet. They're goners, and it's game over for them. They are quantified zombies, and they cannot be saved or changed. At the same time, the Aeon Sophia is producing alchemically the human extract, the human extract that will ferment, or is fermenting, into the next mutation of the Anthropos, Anthropos 11. So specimens of Anthropos 11 are being born, and some of us already alive are consciously transmuting ourselves into Anthropos 11 by following the Sophianic vision story and by attuning ourselves to correction. And that, by the way, is the only way it can be done. It can only be done in conscious and deliberate coordination with her story. Obviously, it can't be done accidentally. It's a conscious self-mutation from the old humanity to the next humanity, from the former humanity to the coming humanity. So, are we working towards saving Anthropos 10? Absolutely not. There's nothing to save, they can't be saved, and they're not worth saving. It's dross, this great mass of humanity, stuck in the syndrome of Anthropos 10 and caught in the archontic maze of informational technology and artificial intelligence and the illusions of that maze and the illusions of power of government and media and religion. Those human animals are dross. They are, as Kali would say, rubble on the cremation ground. And it, at the same time, simultaneously, there appears upon the face of this planet, at the end of this kalpa, in the last 200 years, the transmuted, trans-speciated examples of the human genome to be designated as Anthropos 11. Is that clear? Do I speak of extinction? Oh, indeed I do. Extinction is underway, but not perhaps in the way that scientists think it is. I would venture to say that the Aeon Sophia herself, through the operations of her first attention, is engaged in a kind of stealth operation of extinction. There are physical signs, you know, that extinction is looming close in the future, mainly the eruption of the methane fields, methane being lethal to the human animal. One of the exciting things about the time we live in, let's face it, folks, is that you could be in the first row of a major extinction event. But it's a selective extinction. Let me make that crystal clear. A selective extinction combined with the extraction of the larval form of Anthropos 11 from the general population. Okay, so what does all this mean, and how does it relate to the Calico War Party? Well, getting back to Susanna's question, what exactly does it mean to take a stand in Sophia's correction? Well, I'll tell you what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean correcting the social order as it is. It doesn't mean getting involved with the many specimens of Anthropos 10 who are running around and trying to, as the old analogy goes, install new deck chairs on the Titanic or make sure that there's a program of organic food served in the restaurant on the Titanic. Taking a stand in Sophia's correction means taking a stand against the illusions of Anthropos 10, including the illusion that society can be changed for the better within the parameters it currently operates. Taking a stand in Sophia's correction means taking a stand for Anthropos 11 and against Anthropos 10. So it is in some respects a conflictual situation, but you already know that, don't you? Because you're in it. Remember that her correction is a diorthosis. It is a two-way correction. Two things happen at the same time. As in an alchemical process, the dross is burned away at the same time that the true metal of transmutation emerges. Or in the biogenesis of a dragonfly, the living carapace of the dragonfly nymph gradually atrophies and dies away as the winged dragonfly emerges into flight from that nymph, from that larval form. You might recall that I said some time ago that the figurehead on the bow of the mother ship is the larva of a dragonfly that is called a nymph. It's not called a chrysalis as it is for a butterfly. It's called a nymph. If you go and look on YouTube, you'll find some really amazing nature clips of dragonfly nymphs. Curiously, a dragonfly nymph is different from the carapace of a butterfly or a caterpillar from which a butterfly emerges. A dragonfly nymph is alive, and actually it's a ferocious predator. It's a creature. The larval form of the dragonfly is a creature in its own right. It's amazing. Go research this. Just put it into the search bar, YouTube. So the larval form of the dragonfly is on the bow of the mother ship. And what emerges from that nymph is the full-blown winged dragonfly representing the capacity of the Earth not only to propel itself through interstellar space, but to navigate free of the capture of the Archontic planetary system. There's a kind of a membrane that separates these two forms, the larval form and the free winged dragonfly, the fully mature insect. There's kind of a membrane separating them. I call that the membrane of her perfect dreaming. As correction proceeds in these remaining 6 months, those of us who follow the Aeon Sophia, who participate in her liberation, are actually pushing that membrane with her. In the GNE, you are pushing the membrane of her perfect dreaming to the moment of its puncture when the dragonfly emerges. In doing so, you live in two worlds at once. Certainly, the dying world of Anthropos 10 is still up and running, and many people that you may meet, depending on the circumstances of your life, are living the last moments of Anthropos 10, while you, standing face to face with them, are living the initial moments of Anthropos 11. And this is how you live in correction. You live in the diorthosis, or the two-way solution. What is the solution for Anthropos 10? To die out and be composted. The solution for Anthropos 11 is to move into perfect harmony and alignment with the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia and everything that that entails, all the implications of that, as far-reaching and magnificent as you can allow yourself to imagine. So returning to Susanna's question, where does the Kalika War Party play into this? Well, this brings me around to Castaneda, of course. I want to talk about his war party in a moment. But just let me make something explicitly clear, in case I haven't done so till now, and I guess I haven't. The purpose of the Kalika War Party is to defend Anthropos 11 against Anthropos 10. The purpose of the Kalika War Party is to define positions within this world in the two-way solution. As long as any of us is still positioned in the world of Anthropos 10, but carrying forward the potential of Anthropos 11, you have to take a stand against the world you are leaving behind. You see that? And that stand needs to be defined very clearly in terms of your function relative to Anthropos 10 and to the whole world drama and psychodrama that it carries. And that is why I have proposed this depiction of the V formations of the ranks of the Calico War Party. Now I have here, right in my hand, dated 23 February 2012, no, 2013, 23 February 2013, not so long ago, the first sketch I made of the V-shaped ranks in the Calico War Party. Let me remind you that the top rank, or the first rank, consists of three Vs. Kurukula on the left, that is the taboo busters, or the motley crew of male and female warriors. The male warriors following Kali, central, and the female warriors under Matangi on the right. Those are the first three ranks. Following them are two other ranks. Interestingly, Shodashi on the left and Bairavi on the right. And then beneath that, a single rank of Vishvamata. This is as far as I can go right now in the outline and portrayal of the Calico War Party. Well, what is the purpose of this particular model? It's a model. It's a paradigm, if you will. It's a model of social behavior. How are you going to behave if you accept to be deeply immersed in the two-way solution? Well, the way that you behave toward other GNE crew members and people in Planetary Tantra and those who follow the Sophianic Vision story and those who are in Sophia's correction and observe it consciously is one thing. The way you behave toward everything else is what defines your position in the Calico War Party. Do you see that? So the Calico War Party is a tremendously important strategic model for living out the rest of your life in the experience of correction. And even after the 3 years is completed in March of 2014, I expect to be saying some things about the particular strategies and activities and commitments and challenges and battles to be fought by each V-shaped formation in the Calico War Party. And as you place yourself in that formation, you gain confidence. You gain certainty of knowing where you can take a stand in Sophia's correction. So that's how I would answer the question, coming from Susanna in the East Village, where I used to live and where I met Jan Michelle Kerouac many, many, many years ago. So how does all this relate to Carlos Castaneda? Well, I'll see what I can do in the remaining half hour of this talk to show the relevance of Castaneda's myth and message to the moment we are facing today in the GNE, this critical, magnificent, promising moment in Sophia's correction. Some of you will recall that I notoriously stated in a remark that could be considered to indicate extreme arrogance and presumption on my part, that Castaneda was the warm-up act for Planetary Tantra. Well, I confess that I felt quite a shiver of delight at the outrageousness of that claim when I initially said it. But I can tell you now, as some years have gone by, that that initial thrill has settled down into a permanent thrill, and I am more certain than ever that the statement is correct and true, no matter how outrageous or presumptuous it may seem to be. After all, what am I doing, making some kind of comparison here? What am I going to do, call myself the Nostra Castaneda. Nah, I wouldn't do that. I'll let someone else go for that one. What I do claim, however, is that the tremendous momentum of excitement and mystery generated by the writings of Carlos Castaneda, published over 33 years, from 1968 to 1999, represent a prelude to Planetary Tantra. They set the stage for Planetary Tantra. It's the warm-up act. And I stand by that statement. To be exact, it would be, 31 years. The bibliography of Castaneda's work I'm currently looking at on the internet gives 1968 as the publication date of the teachings of Don Juan. Well, I remember that moment very well. In fact, it was in September of 1968 that Jan Kerouac and I were living on Oak Street, down from the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And a friend of mine at the time, Hilaire, whom I had met in Madras, India, a couple of years previously, was visiting us. Hilaire Heiler, the son of the Bohemian painter from the Paris scene of Henry Miller and others of the 1930s. And Hilaire had been over to the other side of the Straits on that day. He'd been over at UCLA in Berkeley, went to the bookstore, and came back with a hardcover copy of the first edition of the Teachings of Don Juan and placed it in my hands within weeks, if not days, of its publication. That was in August or September of 1968, so I read the Teachings of Don Juan, and then I continued to follow the books of Castaneda as they came out in the remaining 31 years until The Active Side of Infinity in 1999, published posthumously 1 year in the year after his death. Now, there could have been only a handful of people who read the Teachings of Don Juan in 1968 when it came out. As each successive book appeared, A Separate Reality in 71, Journey to Ixtlan 72, Tales of Power 74, Second Ring of Power 77, The Eagle's Gift 1981, and so on, Castaneda accumulated an enormous readership, not only in the English-speaking world and the Spanish-speaking world, where the books were translated, but in many European languages, particularly in Germany. And so, what you have is the phenomenon of Carlos Castaneda, the cult of Castaneda, which was a literary cult. I want to point that out. It was a literary cult. Planetary Tantra is not a literary cult. During those 3 decades, those of us who loyally and passionately followed Castaneda from one book to another were in fact engaged in a literary experience, because all that we knew about the Neo-Toltec sorcery unfolding in his stories came from reading about them. I don't know about anyone else, but I'm pretty certain that among the millions and millions of readers of his works in those 3 decades, they were, like myself, literally limited to the literary aspect of those works, the literary revelation, as it were, in the genre of magical realism, of a new paradigm of sorcery. But it was not the practice of that sorcery as such, although it did become so, apparently, in the last decade with the emergence of the magical passes and the seminars and the teachings and the Chakmulwuls women that were supposedly the real life personalities corresponding to the characters in these 10 or 11 books. Okay, well, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure if they were the real-life personalities corresponding to what was written in those books. But I can guarantee you something right now, that you and I are the real-life personalities in Sophia's correction. And we are the real-life personalities living currently in the story of Planetary Tantra and the unfoldment of the Calico War Party in real time. And in that respect, this phenomena of sorcery, which I call the sorcery of love and intention, Planetary Tantra, the Gayan Tantras, in that respect, this event is more real, more alive, and more engaged than was the phenomenon of Neo-Toltec sorcery coming from Castaneda, which was driven simply by vicarious participation in a series of books. So I not only claim that Castaneda's work was the warm-up for Planetary Tantra, I'm also claiming that Planetary Tantra is more advanced in some aspects, far more advanced, more vital, and more engaging than anything Castaneda ever wrote. That is my claim. And to further support that claim, let me point this out. During those 30-odd years, starting in 1968, millions of readers around the world, that is a growing readership, escalating readership, book by book, eagerly awaited the appearance of Castaneda's next book. Some of us are old enough to remember what that felt like, to remember what it felt like to read A Separate Reality and then live in the eager anticipation for his next book, which happened to be Journey to Aztlan. And in effect, those who were drawn into the literary cult of Carlos Castaneda were always in a situation of catching up with him. So by the time Tales of Power comes out in 1974, with its magnificent passage on the sorcerer's explanation of the dual world system, the Tonal and the Nahual, we're reading this. We're reading Tales of Power, but we're not experiencing events of power because we're only catching up with those events through the books in which Castaneda describes them. We're continually catching up with Don Juan and Don Enero, and later on the women who come into the Sorcerer's Party. We're hearing about things they did, and we're catching up with what they did. And let me tell you, in Planetary Tantra, it ain't nothing like that. You're not catching up with nothing. You are current with it as it unfolds. Planetary Tantra is far more powerful in that respect than the literary record of Neo-Toltec sorcery coming from Castaneda. Those in the GNE, those who have followed Planetary Tantra from its inception in the fall of 2008, are not catching up with anything. You are totally current with the magic as it unfolds. You are totally current with the development and definition and deployment of the tactics of sorcery as it is happening in application in this world today, in the situation of transition from Anthropos 10 to Anthropos 11. And that is the power and beauty and magic of this engagement. And it leaves Castaneda in the dust. Now, a second point I'd like to make while I'm boasting wildly about my attainments and achievements. There is another way in which Planetary Tantra is vastly superior to Castaneda. Do you know what that is? It has to do with a distinction that I made in my book, The Seeker's Handbook, published in 1991. That was the time, say, when just after The Power of Silence came out, few years after The Power of Silence came out and 2 years before The Art of Dreaming by Castaneda. In the Secrets Handbook, I referred to the relation of the actual to the invented. This is the syntax, the actual and the invented. And the relevance of that syntax to Castaneda is like this. From the inception, from the very first book, Carlos Castaneda tricked the imagination of his readers. He tricked them. He duped them. He used a sorcerer's tactic of stalking or trickery. How did he do that? He did it by presenting the teachings of Don Juan as an anthropological report of fieldwork done among the Yaqui Indians of Mexico and Arizona. And he presented a fictional account as if it were a literal, factual anthropological report. So, that was a very, very clever device, because it actually empowered the imagination of people who were due to follow Castaneda's work. It actually was an empowering gift to the readers. It was not a trick or deceit. It empowered them to engage in the capacity of their own imagination to take something that was invented and make it real. But the deficiency in that technique was that Castaneda did not admit that it was invented. And he couldn't have. It wouldn't have worked if he had admitted that it was a fabrication or invention based upon some possible researches that he had done and some old Indians that he met in a cafe somewhere in Arizona or at a bus station or whatever. He needed to do what he did. It was a master stroke of sorcery. The first master stroke of Castaneda's sorcery was the introduction of the literary device that convinced people that something that he invented was actually so. He was an absolute genius in the way that he pulled that off, and he continued to develop and elaborate it to a fantastic level of invention in the later books, especially in The Power of Silence and The Art of Dreaming. Some of the most exquisite inventions of human imagination occur in these later books, such as The Parable of the Tenant, The Rule of the Nahual, even, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, that occurs in The Eagle's Gift, already exhibits this high excellence of invention. But let me point this out to you, that the power of an admitted invention is even greater than a non-admitted one. This is a rule of creative mythology. And what I say to you now is that Sophia's correction is an admitted invention. Planetary Tantra is an admitted invention. But it's not the invention of the Turton, John Lamb Lash, who discovered it. It's the discovery of the Turton, of the invention of the imagination of the entire human race. And the power of the admitted invention is even greater than the power of the non-admitted one. So if you go back and you look at the fantastic influence and scope of Castaneda's work, totally based on a non-admitted invention, maybe you can see what I'm getting at here. Maybe you can see the exponential leap that you make with the Terma of Gaia Awakening and Planetary Tantra, which is an admitted invention. What do I mean by that? Listen. The Sophianic vision story which can be compiled in 9 episodes, describing the real and actual events in our galaxy that produced the situation of the human species now living upon the Earth, was an invention of the Gnostic seers. They invented it, just like Carlos Castaneda invented his series of books and the Neo-Toltec adventures in sorcery recounted in those books. But the invention of the Gnostic seers is a true account of things that happened. It is both an invention as far as it is a description, but it is not an invention as far as that description refers to real events. It is, nonetheless, an invention of human imagination that you encounter in the Sophianic vision story. And in the 9th chapter of that invention, the Gnostics presented the theme of correction. What is correction? It is an invention of the human imagination in the attempt to understand the experiment in which we are embedded. It is a product of human imagination, but it is a product that addresses the reality of the human situation in the laboratory setting of Earth under the anomalous conditions of Anthropos 10, now phasing into Anthropos 11. And I submit to you, with great delight and confidence, that the power of that admitted invention is greater than the power of a non-admitted one. And that is such, and that is to be seen and proven and lived and enjoyed and celebrated from this moment on. Now, it so happens that sometime during the Bhairavi shift, beginning the fall season of 2013, I picked up the 6th book in Castaneda's epic cycle of magical realism, The Eagle's Gift. And I started rereading it, and it proved to be very relevant to a number of current events happening in my own life. Now, you might recall that it is in the 6th book that Castaneda states the rule of the Nahual, that is, in fact, chapter 9 of the book. And the rule of the Nahual is a rather complicated affair that describes 2 things at once. On the one hand, it describes the mission of Neo-Toltec sorcery, the mission of those who engage in Castaneda-style sorcery. And what is that mission? Well, quite simply, it is the attainment of the absolute freedom of consciousness by slipping past the ego. In this book, Castaneda introduces the image of the eagle, which is also found, by the way, in Gnostic writings such as the Apocryphon of John, the cosmic eagle or the eagle upon the cosmic tree of life. And he introduces the eagle to present the rule of the Nahual, which says that when a human animal dies, the luminous egg in which it is contained breaks open. And the consciousness that has accumulated, the power of awareness that has accumulated in that egg as a result of the experience of that animal, leaks out like the yolk or contents of an egg, the white and yolk of an egg will leak out if you break an egg. In Castaneda's magical and shamanic description, the eagle is that force in the cosmos which would then, if it were left to do so, feed on that awareness and consume that awareness so that there is nothing left. There is neither continuity in the experience of awareness, nor is there freedom to go further into other dimensions of the universe with that same awareness and to explore those dimensions. But according to the rule of the Nahual, sorcerers can slip past the eagle and they can avoid having their awareness eaten by the ego, because their awareness of human beings, Castaneda says, is the food of the ego. They can slip past the ego and be free. And the rule of the Nahual describes, in one aspect, how they do that. And you can read all about this in The Eagle's Gift, which is well worth rereading, and I might recommend it for the fall and winter reading of 2013. Well, needless to say, this stunning conception of the eagle who consumes human awareness for its food, and the possibility of slipping past the eagle to some kind of cosmic freedom with the full-blown scope of the power of awareness, is a magnificent, truly magnificent achievement. Not only a magnificent literary achievement, but certainly a magnificent proposition of sorcery. Let's face it, this is as good as it gets. I would, however, like to point something out about what Castaneda does at the moment that he introduces this proposition, which he calls the rule of the Nahual. I'm looking at page 174 of one of the several copies or editions that I have of The Eagle's Gift. I read this paragraph. Quote, "The eagle created the first Nahual man and Nahual woman as seers and immediately put them in the world to see. It provided them with 4 female warriors who were stalkers, 3 male warriors, and 1 male courier, whom they were to nourish, enhance, and lead to freedom." End quote. Well, isn't that a remarkable little paragraph of 2 sentences? In effect, what Castaneda is saying, at the very moment that he introduces the rule of the Nahual, which might, in many respects, entirely stand by itself, he's also introducing the paradigm or model of the warrior's party. And he's saying that the eagle, who wishes to consume human awareness as its food, also gave to humanity the paradigm or model of the warrior's party, which would be a group of human individuals who, by their combined efforts, supporting, nourishing, and enhancing each other, would reach the freedom beyond the eagle. I mean, this is truly a fantastically complex and paradoxical creation that Castaneda puts forth here. And I would point out to you the most intriguing fact, I found it intriguing anyway, and I still do, that the moment when he states this proposition, which is one of the 2 or 3 key propositions in the 30-year sequence of his writings, The Rule of the Nahual, he immediately introduces this complex paradigm of the warrior's party. So, do you follow my drift here? Do you see what I'm getting at here? Already, in the year, I'm looking again, in the year 1981, Castaneda introduced a model of the Sorcerer's War Party. And fast forward to 2011, 2012, and 13, some 30 or 33 years later, and I am introducing the Calico War Party. So what is the relationship between these two parties, these two models of collaborative sorcery? What is the relation? How do they compare? How do they stand in relation to each other? Well, obviously, I can't answer my own question in the 5 or 6 minutes remaining in this briefing, so I'll carry over this topic into the following briefing. But just in concluding, let me point this out. Consider it to be a matter of synchronicity. When I picked up The Eagle's Gift this summer, began reading it, I came to this chapter and I noticed the description that I reread the description, already quite familiar to me because I probably read this book at least 6-7 times already. Description of the warriors in this Neo-Toltec sorcery game. For instance, the female warriors are called the Four Directions. The first is the East. She is called Order. She is optimistic, light-hearted, smooth, persistent, like a steady breeze. The second is the North. She is called Strength. She is resourceful, blunt, direct, tenacious, like a hard wind. The third is the West. She is called Feeling. She is introspective, remorseful, cunning, sly, like a cold gust of wind. The fourth is the South. She's called Growth. She is nurturing, loud, shy, warm, like a hot wind. Well, then there are the three male warriors and the courier and all these things. These are extremely detailed and elaborate descriptions of personalities of particular dynamic and magical disposition who form the Neo-Toltec party of sorcerers. And they appear just like that, out of nowhere, in a non-elaborated manner in The Eagle's Gift. And as I was rereading this description, I was struck by the fact that, as a matter of fact, these women have all appeared in my life in the last few months, in the last 3 months, except for one. Rereading this passage in Castaneda, I recognized that Kundry, who is my companion here in Andalusia, fits the description of a westerly woman, and she fits it to a T. I also noticed that the woman of the North, she is called Strength, she is resourceful, blunt, direct, and tenacious like a hard wind, had also appeared in my life in May of this year. And in fact, in the first week of September, I went to visit that woman in France. I also could see that the southerly woman appeared when I was in France on that visit, and that the only one remaining would have been the easterly woman, who has not yet appeared in clear definition in this configuration. Now, why would this happen? Why would I suddenly find myself, or immediately is a better word, why would I immediately find myself, upon rereading The Eagle's Gift, in the company of some women, and perhaps some men as well, I could elaborate a little more on that, who actually fit these descriptions that he wrote in a book 30 years ago? Well, my friends, that is the power of invention of human imagination. Invention is not something in contrast to the actual. The invented, when it comes from the imagination of the Anthropos, is not in contrast or contradiction to the actual. It is the precursor of the actual. The invented and the actual are complementary. And so I find myself, strangely, in a kind of personal configuration with people in my life right now who closely fit the roles and rules of the sorcerer's party proposed in The Eagle's Gift. At the same time, there is another dynamic happening, isn't there? There's another dynamic unfolding, and that dynamic is defined by the term Kalika War Party. So there are two formations. I ask you to hold in your mind, before you, two formations, to visualize two formations. One is the formation of the 8 and 16 warriors in the Neo-Toltec Sorcery Party, proposed 30 years ago by Carlos Castaneda. And the other is the V formations arranged in various ranks of the Kalika War Party that I am currently proposing. I am not saying that these are identical. I am not saying that the one needs to be converted into the other. I think I'm saying something even more wonderful than all that. I'm saying that in some spontaneous manner, due to the power of Castaneda's invention, his model of the party of sorcerers works. His model manifests, it spontaneously reveals itself in people that you know, in the associations that you make within Planetary Tantra and the GNE. And so credit where credit is due. Thanks to Carlos Castaneda for the ability that I now have, and you as well, to recognize and characterize these people in these roles in the dynamic magic of the Anthropos. But it gets even better, because the Calico War Party is not a construction based on a book written 30 years ago, is it? The Calico War Party is a deliberate invention of strategy for the Neo-Toltec sorcery of Castaneda carried forward into Planetary Tantra. And that is the point where I will conclude this briefing, because I've run out of time, and also immediately pick up in the succeeding briefing, which I am going to call The Record of the Three Attentions.